If you use the internet on a daily basis, and chances are you do, you probably don't put much thought into cybersecurity. You know, your network connections, the pages you visit, the files you download. You should be thinking about these all the time. Welcome to And Security for All. Your host is Kim Hakem. We're here to help you understand, in general terms, how and why your cybersecurity should be kept in check. Now, here is Kim Hakem.
Hello and welcome to the show today. I think it's obvious that I am not Kim Hakem. I'm Omar Badran with FutureCon Cybersecurity Events, and I'm happy to be stepping in for Kim today. We are fresh from our Orange County event yesterday, which was a fantastic showing, and we are looking forward to our next show in Pittsburgh. But today we have our wonderful guest, Eric Cabedas, founder of Include Security. And Eric, feel free to jump on in and introduce yourself.
Sure. Eric Cabedas here. As you mentioned, founder of InclusSec. I started the company in January 2011 to create an all-expert team of awesome pen testers.
Well, thank you for joining us today. It's great to meet you again. You know, a quick story here. Eric and I met at RSA, just kind of being in the midst of the craziness that is RSA, and we got to talking, and it sounded like he was going to be a wonderful guest on the show. So, we have it here. Thanks again for joining us. And our main topic today is we're going to be exploring, what is pen testing, the value, and ultimately B2B versus B2C. Eric here is an expert. I saw some of your stuff online, Eric. It looks like you are a pro and you have, extensive experience sharing some of your stuff. So, if you want to start off with just kind of letting our public know, what is pen testing? It's from a level that maybe doesn't have to deal with this on a daily basis, and then we can go a little bit further into the value.
Sure. Just background on myself, I kind of started hacking in the 90s and taught myself a lot of low-level attacks and things like that. And over the years, I've worked in kind of product companies. I've worked in defense on the corporate side. But most of my career has been on what we call the offensive side of security or pen testing. And that kind of takes different flavors. So someone might say, hey, here's my computer network. Can you break into my computer network? Or maybe it's my physical actual office or maybe it's the application that you primarily operate. Maybe you're a SaaS company like Salesforce, and they say, hey, we want to make sure that the service that we're providing for our customers is secure. Can you hack this ideally before it goes to production and gets shared with our customers and tell us where all the vulnerabilities are? So that, in general, finding vulnerabilities for a company that hires you to do that is generally known as pen testing or penetration testing.
That's super interesting. So it's almost like finding a burglar and telling them to go ahead and break into my house or break into my company and tell me, where all the vulnerabilities are.
Yeah. And, a little known fact, most local police departments will actually come to your house and do a site security review if you ask them to. So it's kind of like calling up your local folks that work in that world and say, hey, can you help me out? Except we're not a local police department. We're a commercial consultancy.
That's pretty cool. And do you find any pushback with that? Do you find that some folks are kind of scared to break into my stuff?
Of course, because you're essentially hiring, you and your tech team have worked on this really awesome technology for months or years sometimes, and it's your baby, and you're hiring someone to come in and give a judgment call on your baby, no, you're not cute as you thought you were. No, I do not like. So, of course, it's going to be difficult to deal with that. So the way to do it right is to be professional and objective about it. And a lot of companies are not professional and objective, but that is the highest of importance in the way that we do things.
And do you find that, enterprise organizations are a little bit more keen on doing something like this because of the, level that they have to be protected? Or do you find that more like SMB or smaller organizations are more keen on doing this?
Yeah, so there's kind of the two main sides of tech, right? Are you selling something for consumers to use directly, or are you selling something for businesses to use? Those are kind of the two main areas. And there's different risk factors in the security, if security is affected on each of those. So if a B2B company gets compromised, they may only have a couple thousand corporate partners, or sorry, corporate customers, and you know, the general Jane Smith of the world, Joe Schmo, they don't really care if like some B2B company gets compromised, so they don't care as much. But when the consumer on the B2C side, like let's say your Facebooks and things like that, if they have a breach, then that's their personal information. So you hear a lot more about the breaches on the B2C side of the world, but interestingly enough, the majority of pen testing happens on the B2B side of the world. And that's because if there a breach happens there, you violate all sorts of potential legal situations with contracts, standards, compliance, regulations. There's all sorts of implications when a hack happens on the B2B side. On the B2C side, it's pretty straightforward. You have to deal with the class action lawsuit from the users that whose trust you violated, and then maybe the Federal Trade Commission will come after you. Those are probably the two biggest risks.
That's interesting. I think from I would say a pedestrian standpoint, you kind of think that B2C would be more catastrophic. I know that we've had a few in the past, and people think, oh my God, Target's going away, or that company is going to disappear. But like you mentioned, it kind of fades away. They pay their fees and they just keep going. You actually, as a customer, never know what really happened unless you get contacted further. B2C side is B2B side completely different, right? You've kind of formed an enemy there. What's the value of making sure that is just, do you lead with that whenever you're approaching a company and you say, hey, maybe, you should get some pen testing done? Do you kind of lead with the potential risk?
Yeah. So to kind of those four things I mentioned, the regulations, the standards, like let's say SOC 2 type 2, compliance like PCI DSS, regulations might be things like FDA or FINRA or SEC. And then contractual obligations. So if you're selling B2B software, let's say you're Adobe, you're Microsoft, you're one of these large companies selling software to other large companies, they bake it in those contracts and says, hey, we're going to do our due diligence on security. We're going to do annual pen tests or source review or whatever that is. It's built into those enterprise agreements. So there is legal liability from each of your customers in their agreements. So it's a bit more of an immediate risk. Whereas if you had a B2C company, a social network or a music streaming service, something like that, you don't have that like contractual obligation. So there's a lot less expectation from the legal side there. It's still bad in either case if you get hacked and have security problems. Like I mentioned, on the B2C side, you could definitely have some class action lawsuits and things like that. But there's more immediate need and requirement. So on the B2C, on the B2B side, when we go to potential clients and we say, hey, do you have, you're a health technology company. Do you have concerns with like staying in HIPAA and FDA compliance? Like we can help with that.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you're dealing with a lot of different companies. So what are some things that, this is a high value proposition. What are some things that help you along the way? Do you have tools built in? Do you use, things like AI or other things, or are you kind of going in there or you're a cat burglar on your own, hacking in there, making sure that it works?
Yeah, it's a little bit of all three. But for our team specifically, our main differentiator from like all of our competitors is that we are a team of all expert hackers. So we come to the table with a huge amount of intellectual property that all of our folks have. So it's not just the tools that you bring to the table, but the ability to make tools on the fly and exploit new concepts on the fly. So the client brings us in, they're like, hey, we've got the XYZ RPC service, which is like a data transfer protocol over networks. My consultant may have never seen this before because it's a brand new protocol. So the challenge there is if this was just a standard pen testing company, they would be their consultant would be like, I don't know what to do here, and they wouldn't do much. But our folks can look at that, analyze it, understand it, and write the tooling for it. So we do bring, you know, the usual tooling to the table. We like all, you know, Linux, Unix environments, Mac OS, Linux, our typical ways that we do our testing. We use typical tools like on the web application side. We use something called Burp Suite. You know, vulnerability scanners like Nmap and Nessus, all very standard stuff. But really, it's when you take things to the next level of just like being able to make your own tools and modifying your existing tools. And then you mentioned the AI side of things. It's obviously a hot topic these days. With the work that we do with so many B2B companies requiring very stringent non-disclosure agreements, we can't just use every single fresh, hot AI tool because most of these tools operate with hosted models. So the foundational models, you may have heard companies like OpenAI, Anthropic, these types of companies create these models and they pre-train them and they host them. So if you start sending information to those models, they could do anything they want with that information, usually. They can use it to train future models. If they get hacked, your queries and the information from the requests and the responses may be in that. So there's a lot more risk with those hosted foundational models. Mm-hmm. So we're exploring using local models. Like the most popular one that we've seen is called Llama 3. So we're using Llama 3 and trying to do small experiments to see where that can aid our testing locally. It's also just super handy. I talked about writing custom tools. It's super handy to use any model, local or remote, to just make small scripts. So I use AI almost every week to do some sort of small tool for me, like I used one yesterday to check AWS, grab certain information and output a CSV file. And, you know, setting that up with OpenAI took me 15 minutes. And if I coded that myself, it would have taken me 5 hours maybe.
Oh, wow. And so when using these tools, so you mentioned Llama, do you actually have to test the AI model as well for vulnerabilities before you use it?
So if it's a local model, there's no real attack surface area there, so I'm not too concerned about that. If it's a remote model, it's more of just kind of like the concern around where the data could go. So we can't send our client source code. We can't point the AI to look at our client's website because you know, our clients trust us that we're not going to give their credentials or their access or their source code or any of these important intellectual property items that we're entrusted to review for them. We can't give them over to models that are remote, and that's why we have to only use them locally. Now, you mentioned, do we look at any of these models from like the security standpoint? If it's local, the attack surface area is small, so it doesn't really present any notable attack surface area. So not as much.
What do you find as like the main challenges? So now you've graduated from, you know, what we call traditional pen testing, and now you say you use AI pen testing. What are some traditional, you know, challenges that you face using this, or has it made your life much easier?
so just to specify, so we're not doing AI assisted pen testing. We're using AI for one-off assistance in the work that we do, right? AI okay. assisted pen testing to me would be, you point a OpenAI plugin or something towards a website or towards a network and just say go. And there's a lot of companies that do that as products, like Randori, AttackIQ, Horizon 3. They all have something that does some sort of automated network pen testing that's a little AI driven. So what we're doing is, since our company, IncludeSec, focuses a lot more on the application side of things, so it's not as generally applicable as a network pen test. So remember, pen testing could be, you know, the target could be a software or it could be networks. We usually work more on the software side. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure if it did.
I did, because it clarified what I was what I was originally thinking. So I appreciate that. Let's talk about, you know, when you're in these environments, pen testing can sometimes give you false positives, false negatives. how do you go about making sure that those are, you know, in line with what you are kind of giving your client, and also making sure that, you know, you don't run into a circle and keep on having these problems?
For sure. And that is actually a very interesting concept, because you've got the pen testing tooling, and that are usually scanners like Nessus, and you point it at a website, and those scanners have limited information because they're just operating over a network in a black box sort of scenario. And because they have limited information, they have to take best guesses as to, okay, I see this information on the network. And so usually when I see that information on the network, it means this vulnerability. So scanners have to make these guesses. And as a result, a lot of the times the guesses are wrong and you get these false positives. Now, during an overall pen test, a good pen tester will use tooling as well as their own intuition to create proof of concept exploits to prove something to be a true positive and not a false positive. So if you've got a good pen test company, they should not have any false positives in their report whatsoever. Now, this is a very different scenario than what a lot of clients misunderstand as a true positive, but it is not a finding that they care about. So perhaps it's usually called a risk accepted finding. So let's say I have an ultra low risk finding. It's like, you know, some HTTP header that has very, very negligible risk on security. But I find that and I report it to the client. And then the client says, no, that's a false positive. It's not a false positive. It was identified correctly, but the client just doesn't care about it, right? Mm-hmm. So like if you have to kind of ensure that you understand that something is real and the risk is small, and so hence it's an accepted risk versus something is incorrect entirely and it was falsely identified. So like understanding what's a false positive, a true positive, and a negligible risk that you accept, making that determination is something that the clients and the pen test company should have a good dialogue about and understanding about.
Do you have any good war stories about something like this that might have happened to you, or like, you know, you guys are deep in the weeds and you think that one way or another and the customer is not really
sure. This happens all the time, and it's because as a consultancy, you come in and you're just given like, you know, days, weeks, or months to try and get in, understand the environment, report the risks that you feel are a concern. But you don't have the years that the person you're dealing with on the other side has to understand their business, right? So you kind of have to take the stance of like, here's my absolute position. Like, here is me not knowing your business, and you know your business. So I'm going to report not knowing your business and not knowing your risk tolerances of your business unit. You are a business, you know your risk tolerances. So there is this notion of like the consultancy may report something that is not the same as what the client thinks, right? So I may report something that I think is a high risk and the client's like, no, that's an informational because of this backend control that you guys don't even know about, right? And the client knows about that because they are aware of that backend control in customer service or something. Yeah. But you don't know about that because it wasn't in the test environment that you tested. And the opposite happens as well. Sometimes we'll report something as a low risk, and a client, because they're in some like highly regulated industry or you know something like that, they'll go, "Oh no, this is a we found something in a cryptocurrency once, and we just thought it was like not a big deal. We're like, oh, this is kind of a low risk. We don't care." And the CEO of the company wrote us an email to thank us because he's like, this would have destroyed our cryptocurrency.
Oh my gosh!
And you know, we thought it was a low risk, but he thought it was a critical risk. So there is that context differentiation, and you will never, as a consultancy, be able to have all of the context that someone working in that company has. And if you set the tone that the consultancy will not know these things, and it's okay for us to reprioritize things based on what we feel, if you set that context, then you're doing things right.
That's fantastic. So you kind of have to lay the ground level. This is where we stand. This is obviously not where you stand, and still kind of report everything and then come to an agreement as far as, you know, what's really needs some attention or not.
So at the end of the day, it's not up to the consultancy to decide what needs attention or not. It's up to the company, right? So if you're trying to negotiate with your pen test company and say, well, I think I should fix this and I think I shouldn't fix that, that's not what a pen test company is there for. A pen test company is there to expose risk, tell you about it, and then you determine whether you want to take action on that or not. And so if you're trying to negotiate with your pen test company, something may not be right on the strategy of the internal risk. So most of the company, the clients that we work with, the grand majority of them, like 99%, they take what we say to them and they go, thank you. They take it with a grain of salt. They say, thank you. We understand your perspective and we understand why you might think these things. But we actually don't agree with some of them and we're not going to fix that one. And we are going to fix this one. And that's fine. That is how risk should be interpreted and processed and handled. And again, like I said, 99% of my clients, that's usually how it happens.
That's awesome. And so, okay, you're digging into these companies, you're finding out vulnerabilities. Do you come across privacy and security concerns? Like they think that you might be looking at, you know, data that might shouldn't be shared with anyone, or that it's very much, you know, like off privilege. Do you run into that kind of stuff?
So where we think something might be a privacy concern, but they're like, no, don't worry about it. That kind of thing, or?
No, more like, hey, go ahead and look, but don't look here.
So scope. All right. So this is the topic of scope. And this is actually something that I think every single standard and compliance situation, all the regulations, everybody gets this wrong across the entire industry. I'm talking about PCI DSS. I'm talking about FedRAMP. I'm talking about everything, all of them, SOC 2, yeah. Type 2. Everyone gets this wrong, which is they don't define exactly what the scope is. So even PCI DSS, they try and say, oh, the scope is the card holder data environment or something like that, the CDE. And they say anything touching the CDE should be in scope. Okay, well, what if I have third parties? Or do I need a third party pen test? Is that in scope? What if I have second party binary objects that I don't have the source code to and I can't interface with? Is that in scope? So there's many, many, many edge cases to the scope. But sometimes you get companies that are just like, listen, here's my web application. Only test the authentication and the authorization, and that's it. Don't test anything else. That's fine because that is the scope that they define for us, and we are just operating as their agent to help, kind of expose the risk that they're asking us to expose for them. Now, where there's maybe misunderstandings is if that they think that that scope and defining the scope in that way is going to help them meet some of their pen test requirements from their customers and things like that. So a customer may get the report and say, well, all this company looked at was authorization and authentication. So this is not a pen test. So kind of getting an understanding for what your customers need, what your compliance and regulators need versus what you're asking for your pen test company, you have to make sure those are aligned. Because I have had a client come to us and say, I want this limited scope pen test. And we go, sure, we do it. We give them the results. They're happy with the results. And then they go, but I gave this to my customer and they weren't happy with it. And we're like, yes, we told you, like, if you make the scope that narrow, that it's probably not going to be meeting all of your obligations to your customers. So make sure that you understand what you're promising your customers and then request that from your pen test company.
All right. Well, that sounds like a slippery slope that you have to walk sometimes, Eric. But I think
that there's just a lot of ambiguity in the industry, and I think we could really use a lot more specific example cases, and maybe even like a clearinghouse. You know, like in financial risk, there's like Morningstar and S&P 500, and they do the risk ratings as a third party independent. I could see something like that happening in the world of security, because you've got many interested parties. Like, let's say FTC thinks one thing, company thinks another thing, third party researcher in a bug bounty situation thinks another thing. What is the actual risk? So maybe one day there'll be some sort of third-party clearinghouse for risk determination, but that's not happening anytime soon.
Yeah, that was, you know, actually going to be my next question is as far as what do you think is as far as the future or what the trends that are coming up. I'm sure it's already trended enough to where you have your own firm like this. But I mean, pen testing has existed for a long time. And I think that people are starting to see the benefits and the true value, just like a lot of other adoptions. What do you see as some trends, positive and both, you know, even negative as well?
Well, so overall, and I think that for network pen testing, I think AI pen testing is going to dominate that within 5 years, probably 3 years. I think for network pen testing, you're not going to have many individual pen testers do their thing, because it's much more commoditizable than it is on the software side. And I think on the some of the other sides of things like wireless pen testing, that as well, same there. On the software side, every single week, there is a new framework. There's a new server-side framework, a new client-side framework. There's something new all the time. And right now, the velocity of change in the software world is not amenable to AI domination as much as it is on the network side. So that's my personal take. Now, that being said, there's still certain slivers of software that may be dominated by AI pen testing, like let's say mobile. So, you know, there's companies like NowSecure and Data Theorem that do automated mobile testing. I think those types of companies are going to be using AI more, and certain slivers of software are going to be dominated. But overall software testing, I wouldn't say in the next decade it's going to be like phased out with manual pen testing and things like that. So that's my prediction. We'll see. Let's jump on 3 years from now and see how close I am.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. If you can put something in there that it can do it by itself and you have some great software, why not? But there's always going to be things that, you know, you kind of just still need someone to go through with a comb and make sure that it's all working properly. What about anything on the other side? What about, you know, do you find that some organizations are just kind of ignoring it and are not really, like, you know, we talked about at the beginning, are maybe fearful of what you might find. So they kind of operate in a sort of high risk environment.
Sure. So, you know, pen testing is a bottom line preservation exercise. It's not a top line revenue addition. So most startups, and I think this speaks to the question that you were asking before, like, hey, do startups or larger companies, like, who's more interested in this? Yep. Most startups are, when they're Series A, B, and C, they're just concerned about getting money in the door, right? Like, I need my next customer. Where's that coming from? How am I getting top line revenue into my company? They do not see security as a business enabler because it's usually not a mandatory requirement for them. Once they get a little larger, then it becomes like a mandatory requirement. They have larger contracts, you know, 6-7 figure contracts with companies, and it just becomes kind of a way of top line enablement, because the organization that is requesting from your customers, the organization that within your customer that's requesting these things is usually the procurement team. The procurement team says, we need to do our due diligence before we buy something, and here are our security requirements. You've got to have this, that, the other. So you're definitely going to take action when the person you're selling to, the literal team that you are selling to, is saying, I can't buy this unless you show me, like, security due diligence.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
That's the thing.
And so do you find, you know, okay, we have established that. And then, you know, we talked about at the beginning as far as, you know, B2B is probably a little bit more, there's more value there, right? Because there's just more risk. Yep. So would you say they need it more? B2B needs it more than B2C, or is it kind of just depends on what, you know, as a organization, you kind of have to make that, that jump for yourself?
So there's two perspectives. One is the altruistic perspective, and the other is the capitalistic perspective. On the capitalistic perspective, B2B needs it more, like, hands down. Yeah. they need it more. They can't sell, they can't sell to Fortune 500s. They need it more. From the altruistic perspective, I just hope that all companies really care about security and aren't, involved in breaches and things like that. I hope consumers' lives aren't destroyed from breaches and things like that. So I would hope that all companies care about security. But realistically, if you were to look at the numbers on the B2C side, despite the hundreds of breaches that have happened to B2C companies, not many of them have resulted in major effect to their business. I think one that came to mind was I think it was Ring cameras, like the front door cameras that Amazon since acquired. That company had some major privacy or security violation when it was before the Amazon acquisition. And they were fined by the FTC something like $5 million. That $5 million doesn't really, it's a slap on the wrist when you're making hundreds of millions in revenue. It's just like, oh, okay, well, here's a line item. We took a risk and we had some security and privacy bugs and here we go. Now, that's just the current state of things. I would love to see the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, have more bite and be able to come to companies and say like, hey, no, like this is now a percentage basis fine instead of a hard value fine. Like that would change the game significantly. If you say, hey, 20% of your revenue has to go towards a fund that protects consumers from security and privacy violations for the next 3 years, if the FTC did something like that, every single B2C company would be like, okay, I care about this now immediately. Yeah. With something that with that much bite. But the FTC is never going to do it because it's a pretty heavy-handed regulation, and it would fail to get traction, I think.
Yeah, I think that I agree with you 100%. I wish there was a little bit more a little bit more bite whenever these catastrophic things hit the news. We're all talking about it, we're like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And then like it fizzes out within a week, and it come to find out that it was just a small fee or fine. But yeah, do you think that some of that that regulation that can't pass is just due because of the thirst for more technology and the thirst for more things being created and invented? Or do you think it's just more?
Yeah, at least in the US market, right? Like in America, we are a very pro-business, pro-capitalistic culture. And so like any regulation, any step to slow down innovation is like viewed as a major no-no. So like that is how we operate in America. And that is why we're the business leader of the world, right? It's because we have like our lane is cleared. We're in the fast lane. Innovate, create new technology, create new business, create new value. So anytime you have something that kind of slows that down a bit to deal with externalities like security and privacy concerns, then you're going to get pushback from the entrepreneurial and general business communities. And understandably so, because it kind of goes to the opposite of the fast forward capital culture.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's ever going to be a thing to prove that you're safe beforehand. It kind of reminds me of like the automobile industry, where you kind of have to show that you have airbags, you have seatbelts, and you have these things. But that took a long time before the government stepped in and said like, no, you have to, otherwise you can't manufacture.
Right, and I think this is correct. I think the story was that before, safety glass and seatbelts, like the number one way people died in car accidents was bleeding out from the glass that they hit when they had a small crash.
Oh my gosh.
So I remember reading a story about that or something. And then the safety profile changed completely because now the number one cause of death in a car accident is speed. Like, it's not the going, it's the stopping. But before, people were dying on like 5 mile an hour fender benders, right? And that's no longer the case. And that's because whistleblowers, regulations, slowly ramp things up. Now, how can we get something equivalent in the security world? I'm not sure, because it's such a complex environment. It's such a gray and complex environment, and it's such a hard environment to regulate. I would hate to be FTC or CISA, CISA, one of the government agencies that kind of works on security. But anyways, that's where we're at.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the camp. You know, luckily I've worked in the in cybersecurity for long enough to be afraid of things. But you know, I've talked to so many young people who, and not only young people, just people who are just not even not enthralled in it every day. And any app could come out and promise anything, and they are just willing to download it and go for it. And I always say proceed with caution. But how can we kind of speak louder and make sure that everyone knows to be a little bit safer, a little bit more secure to the consumer side, but also, to the people who are creating these things.
For sure. At the end of the day, it would be wonderful to see not necessarily regulation, but support from the government. So the CISA, CISA agency, they have a budget of billions of dollars. I think it was $3 or $4 billion a year they get in budget. And for that amount of budget, we should have secure templates for everything that a startup does in American tech culture and export it to the world, right? Like, let America be the leader in security. If I had even a fraction of that, like let's say, let's say $10 million. I'm not asking for $4 billion. I'm asking for $10 million. Yeah. For $10 million, I would create secure templates for every major web application framework. Django, Ruby on Rails, Java Spring, like all of them have secure operational baselines of how to start. I would then go and do a review of all of the documentation of all of the frameworks and all of the books and publish erratas and say like, hey, these books for all of the common frameworks, right? Like, read the top 5 books for each of them, find all the security problems that they're teaching people. So you start with education, you start with secure by default, secure by design. And CISA is actually doing some of these secure by design things right now. But to be honest, it's like, it's aspirational and it's not specific. It's, they're doing things like getting companies to sign pledges that say, we're going to be secure by design to these like 7 principles or something. Yeah. And I'm just like, okay, like this is so slow going. Like, okay, you can have a company pledge that they won't have default passwords, but like, this is just, you are sitting there with a knife scraping an iceberg, right? Like, you need to just come in and like blow the iceberg up and come in from the tactical side, through the foundation side, education, starting points. I love the concept of CISA. I just want to see them move faster. There's so much they could do. And with $10 million, just $10 million, like my company could do like most of those things for the entire freaking internet.
You heard it here, guys. Yep. well, because I imagine, it's one of those strong points that you can actually, you can kind of say, hey, my product is better. I think that, I don't know if this is really true anymore, but I know that like Apple for the longest time, that's what they were preaching, right? It's like, hey, don't let mom and dad get any other phone. Get this Apple one because it'll protect you. There's a layer there that's a little bit more safe than other things. I know that that's kind of been, a myth buster sometimes. However, I think that most people still believe that. And I don't know why other organizations aren't following that lead.
Well, Apple, as usual, is extremely smart. So they took their iOS mobile phone operating system and the iPhone platform, and they integrated the security between those two layers so tightly. And the reason that they did it was they just wanted to have everything. And this is something Steve Jobs started from the beginning of Apple, was if we control the hardware and the software, we can control the whole experience and optimize the whole experience. So that's always been an Apple philosophy since the 80s. And what they did with iOS and iPhone is they kept that philosophy. They got everything together. And to not allow other people to kind of get in there and mess with it, they locked everything down with security. Now, as they're doing that, they kind of come up with this like side benefit, which is like, okay, well, now we really have like a very private and secure operating system. So now we can tell this to consumers and say like, privacy is a huge benefit of us. So we can add that in as a value add that we've done from like kind of sticking to our design principles, but also are helping consumers. So now Apple constantly touts privacy as a feature. And it's very cool to see that from the consumer standpoint. But you, if you think about the larger business context and the design philosophy context, that's probably where it came out. I don't know this for sure. I have no inside information about like exactly how this happened, but this is just based off of what I've read and seen about Steve Jobs and Apple design and the evolution of this platform. This is what it seems like to me.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I'm a consumer, you know, it makes perfect sense there. Do you have any other real world examples of companies that maybe you've worked with or do you read about that have implemented, you know, started with pen testing or started with, you know, integrating security and then have made it, you know, successful, robust part of their organization?
Well, so, you know, from the value perspective, when you're doing security, it's usually a good thing, but it's even more of a good thing when your actual product is security, right? So you kind of see exponential value from like one of the most secure, well-run product security programs I've ever seen in my life was Duo Security, which was acquired by Cisco and is now a Cisco company. But those guys, from the start, they were ultra secure and they just had everything locked down. They got security experts to just make sure that every single layer of their corporate security, their product security was locked down. And because they were a security company, they wanted to push that way. And this made a lot of sense because their competitor was RSA with the RSA security tokens, right? Yeah. So this, if you remember back in like, I think it was 09, 2010, one of those years, RSA's main seed server where the seeds for all of those tokens was hacked into by China, and China took all of the one-time password seeds for all RSA hardware tokens.
Oh, goodness.
Like, that's kind of the worst thing that could possibly happen to you. So Duo was like, listen, we see that the industry needs trust with like their two-factor authentication options and multi-factor authentication options. So we're going to just really focus on security as a value and as a top line revenue generator to add trust and to add value to their products. And I see that with a lot of security companies, but not all, a lot less than you would think. So a misconception is that product security or companies that create products for security are way more secure than normal software companies. And that is not true. I give your average software company a C on average, you know, just a straight C average. I give your average software company that does security products a C+. They're just slightly better on average, right? There's always going to be exceptions like Duo Security just being like solid A+ type of security. But I can't name names who would be D's and F's, but there are companies that make security software that are installed in thousands of companies that are D's and F's when it comes to security, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's super interesting, right? That's name your industry, but yeah, if you sell cars, I would think that you have a fast one somewhere, or any other product. But that's very interesting. I appreciate it. I want to ask you a couple more things just for, you know, before our call. I saw, you know, you have a pretty extensive history, and so just I want to salute you on your career path. I want to know if you have anything as far as like first thing I saw, you have you're on IMDb, you got a couple of interviews out there, and you know, I think it's awesome. So, you know, what inspired you? What brought you to the table to start? You know, you mentioned that you probably started hacking, but what really made you kind of move forward with it?
Yeah, I'm just your stereotypical rollerblading hacker from the 90s. Like, I you know, before Google, I got on what was it, AltaVista? I got on AltaVista, and I was like, how to hack computer, you know, and I found hacking forums that were just full of like script kiddies that didn't know what they were doing, and you know, certain people mentioned more elite forums and IRC chat channels, and so I just kind of like learned and read and spent thousands and thousands of hours just teaching myself Unix systems, Windows internals, coding. And I was actually going to school for material science, polymer engineering. And it was just kind of like a hobby that I was doing on the side. Like I would, you know, try and do schoolwork in college, but then I would also like, you know, spend 10 to 40 hours a week like practicing hacking stuff and learning. So if for any, I think the lesson there, as far as careers go, is just find what interests you. And it's so tough because there's so many things in the world. And some people will say, well, I've never found anything that interests me. There's always something out there. It's just hard because with near infinite topics, you may never find that thing in your lifetime. I was very lucky that I found my thing that I loved in like my very formative years that made it very applicable to be a professional career. It totally could have been that my thing that I loved doing the most was creating like Renaissance fair magic wands, right? Like that could have been my thing. wouldn't have been as commercially successful, but I would have been thrilled doing it. So I don't know. Find your thing, which is my generic, this is kind of a generic advice.
Would you say that there was a memorable experience or project that you worked on that kind of like helped you cross over that barrier and you kind of knew what you wanted?
Yeah, tons. Like for me, it wasn't immediate like lights on switch. There were a couple kind of key milestones that all happened that like helped build this like momentum of interest for me. So like a couple key milestones in like my interest, it was like my roommate in college had hacked my system and took it over with a Trojan. And so like, I was like, what's going on here? What is happening here? And then what was another milestone? Oh, I was learning about AOL IM and I was researching about AOL IM and I heard there was these things called punters and people were punting me and I was punting them. And I was just like, but how does this actually work? Like, what is actually happening here? Just there are those kinds of things in the 90s. And then just a series of circumstances, turning on my cable modem for the first time, like getting high speed internet access. I was like, what is this? And how do I do it? And they're just small little vignettes like that of my life that kind of built up a momentum that one day, I signed up for a class called Exploring the Internet. And I was like, I should take this. And it has a kind of a stupid name, but it was a very cutting edge class for like the 90s. Because it gave you a shell account on an Alpha True64 Unix server. And I was like 19, 20 years old. And I'm like, what is this? Like, what is this black box with the blinking green text? Like I got to figure this out. Like this whole thing is crazy. Like what are these commands that I'm throwing in? So once I took that was kind of like everything just went super fast from there.
Yeah,
they gave me a shell account on that Unix server, and they gave me like a tilde account on Apache, so I could create an HTML website. And I was just like, "What is this? How does this work? Like, I type things here, and then the server shows them on a website. Like, how does this all work?" So they're just like these things built up, and like each kind of step led to the next one, and eventually it stopped being happenstance and it started being like purposeful. Like I'm now seeking this because this has led to this momentum.
That's awesome. So thirst for knowledge, find what you love. Let's say somebody thinks they love AI pen testing. What are some steps they can, what are some steps they can do to kind of get better, enter the world? I think that, for me, I look at it like it's cool, but I'm not going to start something new, but there's plenty of people out there who are. So, what's the path for them?
So there's two ways I'll answer that. One is AI pen testing and one is, pen testing with AI. Pen testing, they're both valid. They're both valid like topics to explore. Pen testing with AI. I think, there's a lot of smart people out there working in that domain space. Their names escape me off the top of my head. I have them all on LinkedIn. Maybe if there's some show notes or something, I can drop a couple folks that are really expert in the space. But there's a couple people that are like really put out a lot of cool frameworks and things that utilize foundational models. And that is totally fine if you have a scenario where you're just kind of playing around on your own or doing bug bounties or something like that. If you're doing commercial pen testing, you really need to make sure that your clients are okay with it before you do use that in a commercial pen test. Again, from what we talked about earlier with the NDAs and liability and things like that. So pen testing with AI, that like, follow the people that do that stuff, get their frameworks, and maybe contribute to their frameworks if you can code. Now, pen testing of AI or AI pen testing, that kind of has two flavors. One is the foundational models themselves, and the other is the people who operationally implement the foundational models. So if I am Joe Schmo SaaS company, I'm making a SaaS company to help people with marketing. I may say, okay, hey, all of the marketing campaigns that we've ever done are now in this database. And I am a marketer. I don't want to go and make a custom report and dig into that. I just want to interact with an LLM and ask, what marketing campaigns did we have in 2023 that were very successful, right? Like you can ask that to an LLM that is fine-tuned trained to your marketing data. So these are the implementers of foundational models. These are the people that take these foundational models and put it into their website. So pen testing that, you want to look at things like the OWASP LLM top 10, and you want to find out more about that world of just like, what are LLMs? How can I pen test them? And do some of these things called capture the flag contests or CTFs. So there's one that one of the guys on my team wrote, which is called DoubleSpeak. So I think the website is DoubleSpeak. Yeah, doublespeak.chat. Actually, can I put that in here in the comments? Or all right, never mind. Maybe one of the show assistants can help us. So the website's doublespeak.chat. So once you read up about it, you learn about the techniques, then you can start doing CTFs to practice it. So that's on the implementer side. And then the foundational model side, that's the heavy hitting stuff. That's the stuff that you really got to spend 1,000 hours plus studying, because you have to understand really difficult math concepts and computer science concepts. You have to understand all different ways of storing and operating with data, such as vector databases. And yeah, you have to really get into that area of expertise. Now, if you are a foundational model expert and you spend that 1,000 hours to get to that level, you then will be like super high in demand. Like everybody in Silicon Valley is going to pay you like huge six-figure salaries. The next level down from that would be kind of like from the, like how lucrative is this? Would be like if you were to do pen testing of LLMs, I think that's a very in-demand skill set. And then kind of the next level down from that is pen testing with AI.
All right. And so get your CS, get up on math, and dig in there. And, you know, you'll probably catch up maybe whenever things you need to learn something new.
Well, you don't need a CS degree. You can teach yourself a lot of these things. Just be aware.
Okay. All right. I know I'm a CS dropout. So super interesting, but I couldn't keep up. But we're getting to a close here. We only have a few minutes. Eric, I would like you to go right ahead and tell us about Include Security, what our folks who are listening want to know a little bit about it, and then just pass the mic over.
Sure. Super simple. Include Security is an all expert team of penetration testers. We primarily focus on software or anything adjacent to software like cloud systems, containers, things like that. We have done every type of assessment that you could think of, from smart cards and operating system kernels all the way up to web and multi-tier peer-to-peer systems. So if you need an all expert team of hackers that don't break the bank, surprisingly, like I don't have a team of 100 salespeople, so I try and pass those cost savings on to my clients. If you ever need us, hit us up. It's includesecurity.com. And Omar, back to yourself.
All right. Well, I appreciate you being on the call, Eric. Fantastic. I learned a lot. I need to get things pen tested right away. but I really appreciate it. You know, we were in Orange County just yesterday. We had a great show. I don't think that you're even close to there, Eric. Whereabouts are you?
Downtown Brooklyn.
Downtown Brooklyn. All right. Well, the next time we get close or nearby, we'll make sure to have you as a personal guest. We were in Orange County again yesterday, and we are going to be in Pittsburgh on July 11th. So if you would like cybersecurity events, you want to meet and greet some leaders of your region, reach out to us, come see us. We're here, and we're going to be in your region coming soon. So thank you again for joining us. It's been a great show. This is End Security for All, despite my background. And I'm hope that you will join us again next week. We're actually going to skip a week, so I'm sorry. The week after that, and then we will have another fantastic show for you. Looking forward to it. And so the way Kim would say would be stay safe and stay secure. And thank you again for joining us.
Thank you for tuning into End Security for All. Be sure to join your host, Kim Hagem, for another episode of the show next Friday at noon Pacific time and 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. And don't forget, you can follow Kim on LinkedIn by searching for Kim Hagem. That's Kim, H-A-K-I-M, to keep yourself posted on all of her upcoming cybersecurity events. Are you a cybersecurity professional that needs to earn continuing educational hours? FutureCon Events brings high-level cybersecurity training, discovering cutting-edge security approaches, managing risk in the ever-changing threat of the cybersecurity workforce. Cybersecurity is no longer just an IT problem. To learn more about attending a virtual event, go to futureconevents.com or email info@futureconevents.com. Or follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter at FutureConHQ. Don't miss the weekly FutureCon Seamless podcast series, focusing on the insights and thoughts of chief security officers and industry pioneers making a difference throughout the world. Kim Hagem, CEO of FutureCon Events, and Darren Anderson, CEO and co-founder Next Robotics, host Seamless Podcast, started by a team of entrepreneurs with experience in fields like smart cities, technology, cybersecurity. The result is a series of podcasts unlike anything you've ever heard anywhere. Listen where you get your podcasts, including Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher.